Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, for our recipes, culinary ideas from around the world, or our latest cookbooks. Now, here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Belgian cookbook author Regula Isewyn taught herself English by reading Pride and Prejudice and also by watching soap operas on the BBC. This week, she tells us how her childhood fascination with British culture led her to study British baking history, from jam roly-polies to giant gingerbreads. She explains what it takes to adapt 18th and 19th century recipes for modern bakers.
In the past, recipes weren't written as very solid instructions as they are today. I mean, today we exaggerate almost in how we write a recipe. It's like you're holding someone's hand and everything is explained, sometimes into the ridiculous. But in the older cookery books, the recipes are tiny.
Also coming up, we make passatelli and brodo, a simple supper from Bologna, and Adam Gopnik ponders outdoor dining in New York. But first, it's my interview with reporter Amy Gutman, who brings us the story of the Kama Bar, Estonia's chocolate-less chocolate bar. Amy, welcome back to Milk Street.
Thanks, Chris.
So since we last spoke, you've been to Estonia, right?
I have, yes. I went there to chase some fake chocolate and the history of Estonia's production of a fake chocolate bar.
So you spoke with Otto Kubo. He's the oldest employee at Kalev, the place that makes this chocolateless chocolate bar.
Yes. So Otto Kubo is Kalev's oldest employee, and Kalev is the oldest and only chocolate company in Estonia. He first came to Kalev as a chemist back in 1955. He's really become the face and ambassador of Kalev. And he gave me a wonderful tour around the Majasmak Cafe in the capital Tallinn. Both the confectionery company and the cafe were joined together years ago in the Soviet era.
During 100 years, we had here in Tallinn more than 40 different sweet factories. And this was the oldest here. But in 1940, the Soviets came and nationalized everything and merged them into one big state-owned factory.
So they produced marzipan for centuries. Marzipan was used as a medicine against headache and broken hearts. That's wonderful. And then, of course, chocolate. So what happened?
So in 1976, there was a major cocoa crisis around the world. Prices rose 5 times current levels. Cocoa simply became inaccessible to countries in the Soviet Union because trade was centralized and states lacked the buying power. Estonia's only chocolate company, Kalev, had already been working on an alternative to simulate the taste of chocolate, and they were experimenting with this local group of flours. This is rye, wheat, barley, and pea flours. These are all indigenous to Estonia. And historically, this group of flours, kama, is typically mixed with sour milk or yogurt to make a cooling summer drink that everyone drinks. And again, it's been around for quite some time in Estonia.
In the 18th and 19th century, kama was used by the peasants when they made hay in summer. They put kama flour into sour milk and added a bit of salt. And it was very good and also healthy.
So how did someone come up with this idea? I mean, you're making a chocolate bar with rye, wheat, barley, and pea flour?
So I think it was fairly obvious to them to take something that was already very familiar. I mean, kids and grown-ups all drink kama. So they took this group of flours and they mixed it with coffee, evaporated milk, sugar, and a couple of other magic ingredients to create the kama bar, and it's beloved.
During those days when we produced in very big amounts kama in the 80s, we sent Siberia and even to the Far East.
So the bar was discontinued, I guess, at independence in 91, but then it came back 10 years later. Why would a chocolateless chocolate bar go back into production?
So you're absolutely right. Once they gained their independence in 1991, the kama bar was retired in favor of all the international branded products. But yes, less than 10 years later, there happened to be a situation where a group of pensioners or senior citizens went to visit the Kalev factory for a tour, and they were asking about the kama bar. Why don't you make it anymore? We really want it back.
And then we started to make kama. During a short time, more than 1,500,000 kama bars were sold.
I mean, the question is, obviously, is it something you'd want to eat or not? You know, if you can get the real deal.
You haven't tasted it yet, Chris, have you?
Okay, well, I have it here. It's got this nice package, although it does have a certain sort of Soviet-era feel to it, I'd say. and it looks like milk chocolate. It's not dark. So I'm going to just bite into it.
First impressions?
I really like it.
You do?
You know why I like it? Maybe because I used to be a hippie. It's not an overwhelmingly sweet, luxurious hit of dark chocolate. It's more complicated. It's not that it feels healthy. It just has a more agricultural depth to it. It's interesting. I kind of like it.
I don't think I've ever heard that description of a food before, an agricultural depth. Not as creamy as milk chocolate. A little more earthy.
But it's good. It's good. I'm shocked. I'm shocked that I kind of like it.
Well, I'm pleased. I think that's terrific. I think you might be an honorary Estonian now.
So here's my question. You know, here's a bar from the Soviet era. Now Estonia is independent. Why would a throwback fake chocolate bar come back into vogue?
I think the major reason why it's so popular is the nostalgia for a very large part of the population, not just the older folks. I mean, this 30-year-old woman, Helen, that we spoke to, had some wonderfully fond memories.
Yes, it reminds me of my childhood, the old town, city center, this particular cafe. I was here on my lessons of English, and so me and my mother came here, bought the gummy bar, and then we went home.
She just had such a warm smile on her face as she described it. Whenever you have this kind of food that you're given by your parents as a child, I guess a lot of us have fond memories of that. So that's one really big driver. But the other factor is, if you think about it, Estonia's gained independence since 1991. So that's not very long ago. So the younger generation that's coming up will not have the same negative association with the Soviet era. They'll just see this as something cool, and they are seeing it as something cool.
Amy, thank you so much. The story of the Kama bar, a fake chocolate bar that I actually like. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
That was reporter Amy Gutman. Right now, my co-host Sarah Moult and I will be answering your cooking questions. Sarah's the author of Home Cooking 101 and star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on Public Television. Sarah, how are you?
Chris, I'm great, and I'm ready to go.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hey, this is Daniel.
Daniel, how can we help you?
I'm curious to know what y'all would suggest as far as what kinds of knives every home cook should look to have in their kitchen.
Well, I assume you don't have an hour to talk about this, so we'll keep this. I could go on forever. There are three or four knives. I would buy a nikiri. It's a Japanese vegetable knife. It's 2 inches deep. And it's very thin blade. It's just an amazing knife to cut through vegetables. The basic concept is the thinner the blade, the less metal has to be pushed through the carrot or whatever. Secondly, a Chinese cleaver, which is 4 inches deep. It's heavier. A good Chinese cleaver, Lamson makes one, for example, is on the thinner side. They're great. Some sort of paring knife, you know, a smaller knife, 4 inches to 3 inches for small stuff. The last knife is up to you. You can get, you know, like an 8-inch chef's knife, all-purpose knife is fine, or the Japanese equivalent of that if you like. And that would be it. But I think the nikiri and the cleaver are the two knives I use the most. I use it for 80-90% of what I do. So, Sarah?
Well, interestingly enough, I would do something different, but there you go. I would spend some money on a really good chef's knife, and I would go with the 10-inch chef knife. Because you can just get so much more done with it because its sweet spot, which is the spot from the bolster to, say, the middle of the knife, is much larger on a 10-inch chef's than it is on an 8-inch. Then there's two different styles, the Japanese, which are thinner knives, harder metal, and sharper edge. And then you have the German knives, which are heavier, much heavier. The heft helps you to get through the vegetables or whatever you're cutting. So you have your choice, but I would spend most of my money on that chef's knife. And then aside from that, I would get a serrated and a good paring. I also like to have a boning knife. A boning knife will get into places and joints and angles that you just can't do with a paring knife.
Yeah, I think those are good. The one thing I would caution, though, is I find those heavier European knives to be difficult to control. You're more likely to cut yourself. So my only piece of advice is before you buy a knife, pick it up, hold it in your hand. And if you feel like you have control over the knife, you feel comfortable with it, you're fine. If you feel you're not comfortable with it, it's just too much knife, don't buy it. Now I will be quiet and my co-conspirator can voice another opinion.
I'll very quickly wrap this up. I like having a big knife and I like having a heavy knife because the weight of it brings it down. So you don't have to push it. You don't really have to drive it. It will do the work for you.
Tomorrow morning, I'm going to order you a Chinese cleaver.
Oh, please
and
do.
And send it overnight.
I love it.
I'll take one too, Chris, if you're passing those out.
Now we're like Oprah, and you can have one, and you can
everybody gets a free Chinese cleaver.
At any rate, Daniel, I hope that was helpful. Good question.
It sure
Great
was.
Question.
I will very quickly say that I side with Sarah, and I must have a serrated knife for my sourdough bread.
Yeah,
so I'm right
okay.
there.
That's fair. Just okay. be careful of that big, heavy knife.
Oh, yeah.
Daniel, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, y'all. Thank you very much.
Take care. This is Milk Street Radio. Sarah and I are ready to take your calls. Give us a ring anytime, 24/7. 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
My name's Vivian Presnick.
Hi, Vivian. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Cary, North Carolina.
How can we help you today?
I used to make something from a box mix, and it was a spoon bread, and it just required eggs and milk, and the texture was smooth, and it was similar to a souffle. It was just a great side dish. I can no longer find that mix, and I've been trying a lot of different recipes, and I just can't seem to get it right. I've been researching this on the internet, and they do have different kinds of spoon bread. Some of them call for heavy cream, and some of them call for beating the egg whites separately.
Well, you know what? There's a wonderful book. It's called The Cornbread Gospels. What I came to understand looking at that book was that you make basically a cornmeal mush, cornmeal added to water or milk, and then you cook it sort of like a loose polenta, and then to that you add your eggs. But depending on whether you want sort of custardy texture, you add the whole eggs, or if you want a souffle-like texture, you add the yolks to the mush and then beat the whites and fold them in. Anyway, Chris, what are your thoughts?
I think you really do have to treat it like a souffle. You really have to beat the whites separately. It's about the ratio between egg whites to the base. You might have to use more whites than yolks in this, but I think the yolks should go into the cornmeal mush with melted butter, with milk, then the yolks, beat that in. It should not be too heavy. I think the base should be
pretty
a little
loose,
like a bechamel, you know, which would be a typical base for a souffle. It shouldn't be really dense. That's the first thing to watch out for. Usually when you make a souffle, you want the egg whites and the base to be kind of similar in texture so that they fold properly. So I'd make sure that the base is lightened up and just add more milk until you get a lighter base. And then I would probably double the amount of whites over the yolks to give you a lighter result. And I would add a little bit of sugar, like a tablespoon, to the whites to stabilize them as you beat them, and a little cream of tartar. Definitely use beaten whites separately.
What Chris said I recommend also is adding a little bit of sugar to the egg whites when you beat them. And don't beat them to stiff, stiff peaks.
Right.
Beat them to soft peaks, and then take about a quarter of your beaten egg whites and actually stir it in to the cornmeal base, which will lighten the base, and then fold in the remaining three quarters of beaten egg whites gently and just barely till they're folded in. And that way you won't lose all the volume that you just achieved by beating the egg whites.
Those are really great suggestions. Does it matter what kind of milk I use or cornmeal? A very fine grained cornmeal?
I would say fine.
You don't want a really coarse cornmeal for this. It's fairly refined. You know, this is not something you put in your saddlebag later.
Right.
This is white tablecloth cooking. Yeah. So I think on the finer side, yes, absolutely.
And I'd say whole milk.
Me too.
Okay. I will try that. Thank you so much for your suggestions and help. I really enjoyed talking with you. So thank you.
Thanks, Vivian.
Take care of yourself.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, we're diving into British baking history with Regula Isuen. That and more after the break. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like, just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are, and I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavor of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded like, oh wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just want to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Mo Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my interview with Regula Isuwin. She's a cookbook author and one of the judges on the Flemish version of The Great British Bake Off. Regula, welcome to Milk Street.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here with you in Boston from my house in Antwerp.
I've never been to Antwerp. First of all, I love your book. I love British baking. I love the history. And you just bathe in the wonders of these recipes. In fact, as a girl, I think your dream was to move to England and live in a limestone cottage by a stream. Was that your goal in life?
Yes, definitely. So I fell in love with England hearing a nursery rhyme, which was black swans, white swans, who's coming to England with us? But England is closed. The key is broken. Is there a blacksmith in town who can mend the key for us? And I heard that and I was thinking this must be such a magical country if it has like this big key and everyone's searching for a blacksmith to mend it. And I started asking my parents to go to England like it was some kind of fairground. Everyone was going to Disneyland and I just wanted to go to England. And after some years of nagging, my parents finally gifted me a day trip to Canterbury on the ferry boat. And I remember just putting my feet on English soil for the first time, telling my parents, Mom and Dad, when I grow up, I'm going to come and live here.
You taught yourself English by reading Jane Austen, which really struck me because those are pretty tough books to start your your education in the English language.
Very true. For me, it was Pride and Prejudice, which is, I think, still the best Austen book. Yeah. And to be fair, I first saw the television series with Colin Firth.
So maybe it was Colin Firth that got you into Jane Austen in the first...
It was very possible when he walked out of that pond his wet shirt. But funnily enough, when I started out writing professionally, I asked someone to give their opinion on how I write. And she said, I can see in your writing that that is where you learned your English because the way you write sometimes is a little bit archaic, but it works. And then another place where I learned my English, this is very important because if you learn a language, you should watch a soap series in the language. So I've watched EastEnders religiously my entire life. So I had, on the one hand, I had this beautiful romantic book by Jane Austen. And on the other hand, I had a soap series about the daily life of people in the East End of London. And people always remark that when I'm speaking, they can hear this East London accent in my voice, which is quite peculiar.
I noticed in the book, you look like, with your hairstyle, that red dress you're wearing in one photograph, you look like you were photographed right in the First World War. In other words, your image in the book seems to go with the recipes in the book. Is that something that's very consciously done on your part, or is that just you?
Well, that's just really me. Apart from my love for history in general and in culinary history, I also have a passion for the history of fashion. I actually, in a previous life, studied fashion, so I had to create historical costumes. And I've always found that modern clothing is often so boring and often very ugly as well. I mean, why wear a jeans and a t-shirt if you can wear a beautiful dress with a petticoat and do your hair up and put flowers in your hair and just look fabulous? I mean, my day is so much better when I'm all dolled up. It's great fun, and it's part of my morning ritual, getting up and doing my hair in those victory rolls, they're called. It's 1940s, 1950s style, and I've got all these petticoats and beautiful dresses. A lot of them are even vintage originals from the 1950s, 1960s. And I just think that the clothing of those periods was made for real women, for women with bums and breasts. I'm going to say it how it is, but that's how it is.
So let's move on to food, of course. I have some experience cooking out of older cookbooks, 19th century books. You actually have a copy of the 1737, The Complete Housewife, also called The Accomplished Gentlewoman's Companion. I found there are lots of problems translating older recipes, the ingredients, etc. So when you're reconstructing old recipes, what are some of the hurdles, challenges you have to overcome?
Well, it's something that you learn, obviously. You learn that if they are asking you to use 12 eggs, you should actually use 6 because eggs were just much smaller in the past. And you also learn to read between the lines and learn to see the lines that aren't actually there. Because in the past, recipes weren't written as very solid instructions as they are today. I mean, today we exaggerate almost in how we write a recipe. It's like you're holding someone's hand and everything is explained, sometimes into the ridiculous. But in the older cookery books, the recipes are tiny and they could translate into 3 A4 pages in today's world.
I was in the East End of London at a bakery a few years ago, and she used apricot kernels, which I found fascinating. And you use them as well. You want to just talk about that?
So I use apricot kernels because in the past they would have used a lot of bitter almonds. And bitter almonds are like sweet almonds, but we don't use the word sweet in front of almonds anymore because sweet almonds are the only almonds we still actually generally can buy today. But in the past, there was specifications in recipes, either saying sweet or bitter almonds. And bitter almonds give this amazing scent and taste of marzipan. That's where that flavor comes from. But apricot kernels, although not really almonds, they have the same flavor, the same scent. And the problem with bitter almonds was that in the skin and also a little bit in the almond itself, it contains cyanide, which is, of course, poisonous. Right. Now, apricot kernels still contain a tiny amount of cyanide, so it's still not safe. You can't snack on them. You have to label your jar and say, do not eat, because here in Holland, someone has eaten an entire bag of apricot kernels on the train, and the man almost lost his life. So it is dangerous. But if you take care and you use just the amount that's required in a recipe, which is usually not a lot, and you usually bash them in a pestle and mortar, and you mix it with rose water. And the combination with the rose water also keeps the nuts from oiling, but it together it creates this beautiful ingredient to recipes.
Gingerbread. Years ago, I was in the Lake District with a food historian who specialized in the Middle Ages, and he showed me molds. And some of those gingerbread were like 3 feet high, and they were baked sometimes for celebrations of the king and queen, etc. Could you tell us a little bit about gingerbread? Because I think here in the States, we know very little bit about it.
Yeah, gingerbread is something that you can see all over Europe. We have this joint culture in gingerbread, but we all do it a little bit differently. Now, the gingerbread molds were not as common as they are here where I am in Flanders and in Holland. We use a mold for every gingerbread that we make, apart from the block gingerbread. But in the UK, it was a very, very pricey thing. It was something that was meant for the table of kings and queens. It would have been gilded with actual gold. And it was a very upper class thing, because the people who made early gingerbread were able to afford sugar. They were able to afford all the spices to go in the gingerbread.
Jam roly-polies, you know, cake rolls we call them here, are common in British baking. So what's the history of those? Why are they so popular?
Well, jam roly-poly is actually a pudding and not a bake. So it's boiled. It's basically like a Swiss roll. And instead of using another leavener, you would use suet, because the suet, it can take a lot of high temperatures. And when it is boiling or steaming, little air pockets arrive, and they create something that is much more fluffy. And to the people in the past, that would have been like a very airy bake. While today, if we taste this roly-poly style pudding, we think of it as quite heavy. But if you look at how the climate is in Britain, it is more cold than what we have here in mainland Europe. We have much more milder climate. And while we had these types of puddings like jam roly-poly as well here, it disappeared out of the history books. While in the UK, in Britain, they loved it. They used it as a way to keep warm and to fill themselves up. It's so rooted in British culture.
So roly-poly is not done like a cake roll in an oven. How is it actually cooked?
So puddings, they are not baked in an oven. Indeed, they used to be baked on a stovetop in a boiling pot of water. And at first, they would have been made in like something like a stomach or an animal intestine, like the typical Scottish dish of haggis. And then after a while, some clever person thought, I actually want to make a pudding outside of the slaughter season when we have access to animal intestines. And they started using a cloth, a piece of linen, and tie that. And then they would hang it in a pot of boiling water. Then afterwards, another clever person thought, oh, this is quite fussy. Why don't we put it in a pudding basin? And they created a pudding basin in the 19th century. But of course, it is much more easy and much more tidy to steam it.
Okay, fruitcakes here are not beloved, because a lot of fruitcakes here are actually pretty awful. I happen to love them. Your wedding cake was a fruitcake made months ahead of time and quote-unquote fed cognac every few weeks. I'd like to be fed cognac every few weeks. Could you sell me on this? I mean, you said it was the best, one of the best things you ever had. Why was it so wonderful? And what's the difference between a great fruitcake and a bad one?
Obviously, it has to be made with love. That is the best ingredient. But true, it is. You have to make it with love because you have to love a fruitcake or a Christmas cake for months in advance or weeks in advance. And if you forget and don't love your cake, then you will forget to feed it with cognac or rum every few days or weeks. And you will end up with a very dry cake. And that's not what it should be. It should be beautifully moist and dark and beautiful and velvety. And that is only something you can achieve if you do love your cake and feed it.
This collection of recipes, you will never confuse with any other culture, right? Why are the British so unique in their approach to baking? Is it their history, their culture? What is it?
While French baking is all about embellishments and very difficult techniques, British baking is all about honesty. What you see is what you get, and you can't cover up a Victoria sponge cake in all types of embellishments. It is what it is. It's just two sponge cakes with jam in between, but it better be the best sponge cakes you can make and the most tasty jam you can make. So for me, British cooking, and it has been for centuries, is about honesty. It's about substance over style.
Regula, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for being on Milk Street.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Regula Isawin. She's the author of the British Baking Book. In one of the most famous lines in English literature, Oliver Twist asked Mr. Bumble, "Please, sir, I want some more." You know, Dickens used food as metaphor to criticize the poor laws or maybe to celebrate human conviviality, as when Pickwick celebrates Christmas at Dingley Dell. In A Christmas Carol, he writes, quote, "Turkeys, geese, game, poultry, great joints of meat, suckling pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense 12 cakes, and seething bowls of punch. These all represent a life fully lived, as opposed to Scrooge's very mean bowl of porridge." For Regula Isawin, British baking represents a 19th century ideal. That's the romance of English country life. And that is why food is so powerful. It can be metaphor or just dinner. It's all up to you. It's time to chat with Lynn Clark about this week's recipe, Passatelli in Brodo. Lynn, how are you?
I'm great, Chris.
How would you like to hear about one of my great trips?
As I always do.
You
go for it.
Can't stand it. About a year ago, I was in Bologna. You know, Bologna, until 10 years ago, nobody went there. I mean, it was not a big tourist destination. It's like a 14th century city, the oldest university in Europe. It's absolutely gorgeous. But we went outside to a number of towns. One of them was Montevello. It's on the top of a hill. It's all cobblestone. You can't drive in the town. You have to walk. You know, it's like going to Disney World or something. Only 25 families live there. There's an abbey on top of the mountain. And the best part is there's a trattoria there, Trattoria del Borgo, and the host, the owner, is just absolutely charming, Paolo Parmigiani. You know, he gave us some wine. Of course, that always helps.
Of course.
And you go inside up some steps, and it looks like a little sort of Austrian guest house. You know, it's dark, there's a little bar, and there's a little set of steps going up to the kitchen and back, which is the size of half an RV. It's tiny. But he made passatelli in brodo. Three bowls, breadcrumbs, eggs, grated Parmesan. And he just did this all by hand. It took about 5 minutes, and he cooked it off in broth. It's cucina povera, right? It's sort of, you know, poor food, which is the best food in the world. It's so simple. I don't know. It was just stunning. Now, it could have been the place. It could have been the weather. It could have been Paolo. It could have been the wine.
Or all of that.
But I think it really was the passatelli. It was just one of those classic, you know, dishes in that area. So we came back and decided this had to be on top of our list of things to make here.
It does, because it's really simple. You can't imagine that these really simple ingredients could create something with so much flavor. It's sort of like the best chicken noodle soup you've ever had, and you've made everything yourself, essentially. The noodle here is more like a dumpling. It's short and fat, with a ton of flavor to it. The flavor is actually in that little dumpling. We make ours by putting some Parmesan cheese, panko breadcrumbs. They would use stale bread in Italy. We're using panko to keep everything normal for our recipe. So my bread and your bread might be slightly different. Some eggs, a little bit of water. You mix that in the food processor. It gets really thick, almost like the texture of mashed potatoes. Let it sit for a little bit, and then the fun begins.
Now, do you use like a potato ricer to do this or what?
In Italy, they have a passatelli maker, of course. We obviously did not. So we do. We use a potato ricer, and you want to have a ricer that has larger holes. If you don't have a ricer, you can push it through a cooling rack. You drop it into boiling chicken broth, and they just cook in about 30 seconds, and then you take them out and let them cool so that they get nice and sturdy.
This is a little spätzle-like, right? I mean, it's the same. It is. You have a dough, you grate it over boiling liquid.
Very similar technique. These are a little bit longer, maybe slightly more noodle-like. And the broth here is really important. If you can, you really want to try to make your own broth. We have a couple of recipes on our website, one on the stovetop. It takes about an hour. The other one is in the Instant Pot. So few ingredients here. You really want to have good, flavorful broth.
Well, just buy 3 or 4 pounds of chicken wings and throw them in an Instant Pot for 40 minutes. You're done, right?
Super simple. Yeah. Although I will say I've made this so many times and haven't always made it with homemade chicken broth.
I've used
the base, and it's still really delicious.
Cheater, cheater. Anything else that goes into this, or is that about it?
So really simple to serve this. You put some of the passatelli in a bowl, add that really flavorful broth, grate a little bit of Parmesan on top, and a grating of fresh nutmeg.
No, the nutmeg, I remember that. It seems simple. It is simple, but it kind of made the dish. I never would have think nutmeg, you know, with a passatelli, but it was absolutely delicious. So passatelli and brodo, cucina povera at its best, simple ingredients, perfectly put together. Thank you, Lynn.
You're welcome, Chris. You can get this recipe for passatelli and brodo at milkstreetradio.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Adam Gopnik dines al fresco. We'll be right back. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips@177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you. I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to Milk Street Radio. Right now, Sarah Molt and I will be answering a few more of your cooking questions.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Sean Daxson calling from New Orleans. How are you all today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm very excited to be speaking to you all.
How can we help you today?
Well, since I have been taught about baking and to bake different things from being a young girl, you know, certain things call for kneading. But I, like a year ago, tried to teach my daughter how to bake biscuits from scratch. And I told her, okay, you have to knead. And when she asked me why, I could not for the life of me articulate why. So my question is a why, how, when. Why do we knead? How is the proper way to knead? And when should we knead?
Excellent questions. You know, I've made biscuits for years. Unless you're making beaten biscuits, you don't want to knead biscuits. You want to be very, very gentle with them.
Okay.
I mix the fat and the salt and the leavener and the flour in a food processor that you could do it by hand. Then I add the buttermilk, usually I use, or you could use milk, to the mixture till it's just moist. And then you just want to press it together, but if you overwork it, it'll be tough. Kneading is what you usually do for bread.
Okay.
And the reason for that is you want to create structure. So when the bread rises, it inflates and becomes lighter. There are two proteins in bread flour, glutenin and gliadin, not that it matters. In the presence of water, they form gluten. And gluten is that elastic texture that you get in bread dough as you knead it, which allows the dough to inflate, right? The only secret here is the water will actually do it for you. So if you let the dough sit around long enough, the proteins will come together and form gluten. If you want to speed up the process, however, you do it by hand or do it in a mixer, and that helps create that gluten bond. So in bread, the more you form gluten, the more elastic it is, the more it rises, the lighter the final product. In a cake or a biscuit, the more you develop gluten or pie dough, the tougher it's going to be because those things are not rising like a balloon does with bread. So the quick answer is, for quick breads like pancakes or biscuits, et cetera, you don't want to overwork the flour or the dough. But in a bread dough, when you want elasticity for rise, you do want to do it. So that was my 10-minute speech. Sarah, are you still awake after all that?
No. That was very well done. The other way to make bread without kneading it is to add a lot more liquid. It's got to be a very wet bread. But that would be a recipe that you could look for under the category of no knead bread because you need to have the right percentage of liquid to flour. It's a very, very wet dough.
But there are books about no knead bread baking. You could just get one of those books. It would tell you all about it.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having you on
Mill
Street. Thank you so much.
Take care.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This is Mill Street Radio. If you need some help in the kitchen, give us a call. That number is 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or drop us an email, questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Karit Fakis, and I'm from Corvallis, Oregon.
Hello, how can we help you today?
I have a question about baking cookies. I have a dad who's going to be turning 77, and I always send him something at his birthday, and I always think of something he likes, and I was thinking about old-fashioned oatmeal raisin cookies. But, you know, to me, they always kind of taste kind of sweet and uninteresting, and so I was trying to think of a way that I could kind of make an adult version, and I was thinking about some of the things that I had heard on your show, things like, I think there was a chocolate chip cookie recipe where you subbed a rye flour maybe and toasted it. And
that's right.
Yeah, and I've heard callers talk about toasting nuts, and just seeing if you had any thoughts on how I might make the more adult version, because I hate cooking things that I don't want to eat, and I don't normally eat a regular oatmeal cookie.
Well, I think everything you've suggested is brilliant. Toasting everything, toasting the nuts, toasting the oats, you can do that, or the flour, You can brown the butter, maybe put some other dried fruit other than raisin. All of the things you just suggested sounded smart.
For our chocolate chip cookie you mentioned, we brown the flour in a skillet and then add butter and brown that. So browning and really brown the butter darkly without burning. And then also the spices, bloom the spices in the melted butter when you brown it.
That's a great idea.
That'll add a lot of flavor to it. And you might even sneak in a couple more interesting spices while you're at it.
Like cardamom maybe or something like that. I always think of that kind of as a cinnamon.
And I think the oatmeal cookies, for me, I think have too many spices. I don't like cinnamon in it. And I'd be very, very frugal with the use of spices. But I think browning and toasting flours. The other thing you mentioned was rye flour, which was in our chocolate chip cookies. I think rye flour is bitter. So if you want to make them more adult, substitute out a little bit of the regular flour for rye flour. And that'll add...
So for 2 cups, what do you think? Like maybe a quarter to a half?
I use a cup and a half of oats and then maybe a half a cup of flour, half regular flour, half rye, quarter cup each.
Okay.
Have you experimented on your father this way before?
Nice way of putting it.
I mean, it's like...
I know. I started cooking for my family when I was 10 when my mom went back to work. You know, a lot of it was experimentation and just going through a spice jar. So my dad is pretty used to being experimented on, and he's pretty good. And anytime somebody gives you cookies, I think for the most part, you're pretty on board with what they give you.
Yeah, I think you'll have fun with this. And let us know how it goes.
I will. One last thing. What do you think about sea salt on the top?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm always worried about,
Nice
idea.
Always put sea salt on top.
Salt points things up. Good idea.
Yeah, I think so too. Thanks so much for taking my call.
I our pleasure.
All your suggestions.
All right, Karen.
Thanks.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. Now it's time for this week's cooking tip from one of our listeners.
Hi, this is John Applegate from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and here's my tip. If you want to add a nice, bright citrus flavor to cold dessert recipes, like a ganache or a mousse, without having pieces of zest ruin the creaminess of your finished product, grate the zest with a microplane grater, then squeeze the zest through a piece of cheesecloth to extract the citrus oil. It's better and fresher tasting than an extract, and you're buying the orange or lemon anyway. If you're adding it to a chocolate ganache, wait until the cream has fully melted the chocolate. Cooking the citrus oil with the cream will destroy the bright, fresh flavor. Citrus oils can also be added to salad dressings using the same method.
If you'd like to share your own tip or secret ingredient on Milk Street Radio, please go to 177milkstreet.com/radiotips. Next up, it's time to ask Adam Gopnik what he's thinking about this week. Adam, how are you doing? How's your week been?
It's been reasonably good.
That's good enough for me.
Well, we're living in uniquely complicated and troubled and in their own strange way, rewarding times. And of course, one of the things that I've been obsessed with in the last weeks and months is watching the construction of outdoor eating spaces on the streets of New York City. And it's been a fascinating thing to watch. When outdoor dining began in the summer, it was outdoor dining. Restaurants just took their tables and chairs and picked them up and moved them into the spaces where parked cars once persisted. But then naturally, as the cold weather fell, the restaurateurs of New York, struggling as they are, put on this amazing display of indigenous architecture. Now, some of what became outdoor dining in New York were simply indoor dining brought forward, huts and little sheds. It was spaces that had walls, that had a roof, and that very often had not only a door, but heating inside it. And it was a sort of demonstration of the philosophical principle that all indoors is simply outdoors that is now enclosed. So the notion that this now counted as outdoors was transparently ridiculous. And yet, we perpetuated it. But many of the restaurateurs were more ingenious than that. And what they did is to begin to construct these amazingly beautiful and complicated structures that were simultaneously indoors and outdoors, that had completely open sides, for instance, but a strong roof with braziers, heating elements hanging from it. Other places, instead of having no walls, chose to have no roof. And other places moved towards tents that looked like something out of a medieval tournament. And you expected jousters to be going up and down Madison Avenue. And then there was the invention of the rentable igloo. I don't know if you've heard about the igloos
of New
York.
No, I don't know about that.
You can now rent your own igloo, which seats four. You can bring the igloo outside and have your igloo tea or brunch or dinner. And I know of several couples, particularly older couples, who now have their igloos in their back gardens so that they can retire from their dull, normal life to go to the igloo for a little romantic moment. I don't know if you ever saw the great movie by Robert Flaherty, Nanuk of the North, but it was about how the Inuit used their igloos, and they used them specifically for sharing seal blubber and for making love. So in New York, we have now passed through the full cycle of indigenous architecture. The lesson, if you're wondering.
I'm really wondering about the lesson here.
The lesson is human beings have an unappeasable need for social interaction. And even in the midst of pandemics and even at the top of the hardest crisis that the city's ever known, that will to be alongside our fellow human beings is so strong that we, when we put our minds to it, instead of feeling defeated by the impossibility, we feel lit up by the necessity and the range of possible solutions that comes up from tents to huts right onto the igloo, fills our hearts and cheers our minds as well. It shows us that we are undefeatable in our pursuit of company.
You know, the only thing I can think about right this moment is that very rich New Yorkers, because you have to be rich to have a garden in New York, are going into their igloos for blubber and sex.
Well, I should add, too, that though it's true you have to be a very wealthy New Yorker to have your own private garden, the igloo gardens I was thinking of actually were in what we call laughingly garden apartments, which are basically basement apartments that look out in the back of the building. So maybe we should call these air shaft igloos, Christopher, rather than garden igloos. I have thought, as you know, we live in an apartment, but I have thought of actually buying or renting one of these igloos and putting it in the front hall so we have a place to adjourn to, as Victorian diners used to adjourn to the, It was to the parlor to have cigars and brandies. It does show you that human ingenuity in the pursuit of sociability knows no limits.
Well, I'm also thinking of the totally opposite experience. Maybe it's Norway or Finland. Didn't people used to, if they wanted to have solace and peace from the family, because they had a very small home, didn't they sit in the corner and they were able to signal they wanted privacy and some alone time? So I wonder that people want to come together at the same time. We're all in these homes together as a family. And people also are looking for a way to be by themselves too, right?
Well, this,
I mean, that's a fairly strong motivation in family life.
This, you've put your finger on, or you've drawn a line that's very powerful in my own family, because my wife's family are Scandinavian, Icelandic, and my family, of course, are Jewish. And it's perfectly true. The Scandinavians need to signal the need for isolation. The Jewish side of the family always wants to signal a place where you can gather together and start arguing some completely irrelevant subject. I'm working on a memoir right now, and the first line is, they could argue about anything.
Well, I think the only thing I would say is that I need to get an igloo for one.
You know what I think an igloo for one is called? It's one of those ice fishing cabins,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
So far as has been known, no one has ever caught a fish in an ice fishing cabin, but many people have been drunk and happy within them.
I think that's the point. Adam Gopnik, whether you are looking for argument and togetherness or the Scandinavian notion of being completely and happily alone, New Yorkers are going to both extremes. Thank you.
Meet you in your igloo, Christopher.
That was Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker. You know, the pandemic has changed not only what we eat, but where we eat it. I've eaten restaurant meals outside, although I once had to cancel a reservation. after a foot of snow fell that afternoon. And I've served many meals around a fire pit in Vermont with temperatures in the very low 20s. It turns out that parka and mittens are what to wear around the pandemic table. You know, cooking is the new camping. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late or want to binge listen every single episode, you can download Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. To learn more about Milk Street, please visit us at 177milkstreet.com. There you can find our recipes, take a free online cooking class, or order our latest cookbook, Cookish. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, on Instagram and Twitter at 177milkstreet. We'll be back next week with more food stories, and thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with GBH. Executive producer Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison. Production assistant Sarah Clapp. Production help Debbie Paddock. Additional editing by Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Tubab Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange.